other yak babies, sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast about books on the internet sponsored by books officially. My name is Aaron. I'm here with my personal pals, Dave.
Hello, Aaron.
And Brick.
Hello.
We have a special guest with us today, author Chaya Bhuvaneshwar.
Hello there.
There we go. Fantastic. Calling in. This is our Story Club episode. We've done a couple of these so far. The first one was about Tobias Wolff. The second one was Amelia Gray and...
Amy Bender and Stephen Milhauser.
Yes. And this one... We're looking at two stories, one by Gish Jen called Birthmates, and one by ZZ Packer called Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, selected by our special guest. So she chose these stories. Chaya, tell us a little bit why you chose these two stories in particular.
Well, ZZ Packer's story, Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, is really one for the ages. That story burned into me both because I, too, was a Yale undergraduate.
Oh, interesting.
And actually knew ZZ a little bit.
Hmm.
And the experiences it talks about, just viscerally, you know, what it was like to work in the Yale dining halls and commons, this huge, huge, you can't even call it a dining hall. It's sort of like, you know, eating in a mini stadium kind of thing. All of those kind of experiences contributing to the beautifully described isolation of this character, Dina, and how it echoes a larger isolation experienced by women of color, particularly queer women of color, as we navigate loss, grief. And what I love the most about that story was one of the things that has always really angered me so profoundly, I almost sometimes it leaves me speechless, is when, as women of color and queer women of color, we are judged for our quote-unquote sincerity. Mm. You know, like we are judged for, are you sincere enough or are you authentic enough in how you're talking about what you're calling your experience? Like there's this idea, you know, that no offense, you know, certain white dudes have where there is this platonic ideal of what an oppression experience is or what racism is felt to be like by women of color. And whatever we actually want to say about it is kind of a couple of steps removed from that, and they somehow have the right to judge if
right.
it's real enough.
You know, like right.
If it matches, does it match up to that platonic ideal? And it's very interesting how in that story, it's not a white dude. It's a actually very good-hearted and well-meaning white woman who judges Dina in that way, you know, like in the rawness of her own grief, of Dina's grief about losing her mother. It's like her grief isn't perceived as real or sincere because it's laden with all this sarcasm and humor and bitterness and darkness, you know?
Yeah.
And always kind of twist. And I actually think reading that story and being given permission to write that kind of dark character, dark not only in the sense of our, you know, being people of color, but dark, you know, like saying very sarcastic things, like she has to do that freshman game and you know, everyone say what you're going to be, and she says, I'm a gun.
Right.
You know, I feel like that opened the door for me to be, not, probably not consciously, but I think that was the genesis of the 17 stories in my collection, White Dancing Elephants, which actually, just to kind of bring it full circle, was just on the Rumpus's list of what to read when you want to read short stories, along with ZZ's collection. You know, so that was so inspiring. But and it my collection also received a prize called the Dezang Books Short Story Collection Prize, which brought us some really wonderful writers like Laura Vandenberg, whose first collection was published that way, and then, you know, who has more recently published a wonderful novel, The Third Hotel. And it's also kind of neat that you mentioned Amelia Gray because she blurbed me and she's been a huge support. I love her work. So I guess I want to open up the discussion by asking, you know, does that idea resonate with any conversation you've been part of or witnessed where a woman of color was, you know, in a low-key way saying, well, yeah, you know, this happened to me and it felt really racist and, you know, this felt really wrong to me, and you witnessed a white person, more most commonly a white male, mansplaining to her that, no, that's not really racism. Or, no, that's not really racism, like real victims of racism experience. You know, like this, the idea that they're going to be the authority on that. Is this phenomenon something only we notice as women of color?
No,
it's like rage against, you know, or
it's,
have it, you noticed
it? It's certainly prevalent, I think. And in fact, one of the things I noticed right away about this story that was familiar was the way, after her revolver comment in ZZ Packer's story, the authority figures, who are presumably white, really overreact. They're out to sort of help her get on the straight and narrow. They're suddenly, you know, very aware of her grades and sending her to counseling and doing all these things to sort of make sure that their, you know, their token black girl is, they're overcompensating, I think, from their perspective.
Yeah.
And I think I work in schools, and that's something that you see happening to different degrees regularly. And it doesn't come out of a place of malice, but I think it comes from particularly people in power not understanding the perspective of others and assuming the situation that different people experience, particularly young people and particularly people of color.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing this play out right now in the Kavanaugh hearings, right? It's not exactly it's not a woman of color, but a woman is sort of expressing or sort of, you know, telling her story and being told by elected officials that she's wrong in a you know, sort of mealy mouth roundabout way of doing so. So this is not a phenomenon that's unfamiliar to any of us, sadly. You know, it's everywhere.
Another part in the Packer story that drew my attention, it was when she's walking through the commons, the cafeteria, and the reaction of the black men, and they're derisive, right? And they kind of, you know, because she doesn't fit their expectations of what she's supposed to be either. You know, they want her to be the black woman in their circle, and she doesn't, you know, she's a self-described misanthrope. And she doesn't want to play into their expectations any more than the expectations of the deans or anyone else.
That is so interesting. You know, that is also something where I think there's a way that we quote-unquote reject our own that isn't really rejection per se, but just a kind of mutual checking, it's a dialogue. Hmm. It's not a refusal, because no matter what she does, she's not going to have the option of being outside that identity and the pain that she shares with them. And I think that, too, is really subtle, and it's not that easy. It's almost impossible for her white lover / friend, you know, the woman she falls in love with, really. Yeah. It's almost impossible to share that and communicate to her that, you know, I can say no to them, but in other situations she would say yes. You know, like if she and a black man were both in the Yale bookstore, and a white staff person started following him around and targeting him, she would speak up. You know, you feel that she is equally contemptuous of that guy who's so shiny and happy, and she feels kind of denying race, denying racial disparity, and saying, oh, we're all happy and fine. And the only other student of color in that first, the game that ends up, you know, where she says revolver. So I think that too is really, it's really complex, because it's not equivalent. It's these different layers, and that's another theme that I am so grateful was kind of accepted in my story collection, even though, or, you know, perhaps because, you know, many readers so far and, you know, blurbers have been white, actually, you know, to say I never really appreciated how much women of color and people of color in general can wound each other. And how it's part of a certain kind of intimacy that we wound each other too, you know. I think that's a very interesting observation, though, you know, that the waves of hostility that character, that isolated character, Dina, feels from all these different sources. I think that it's a good pickup, you know. Like, I really think it's so splendid how ZZ Packer really pulls us into that subjectivity, you know, as alone as that character is. there's something so gripping and compelling about her. She's not alone because she's attracting our attention so much.
Absolutely. She seems to want to build these walls, but we're so inside her own walls at the same time. It's a really sort of interesting tension. Can you talk about Birthmates a little bit? I guess when I read the story, I sort of felt there was maybe a common theme or something similar, but maybe a different approach to it, the sort of sense of isolation, a character who seems to be completely alone and yet is trying in a way that Dina in Drinking Coffee Elsewhere is not trying to find himself. Could you talk a little bit about that story and your reaction to it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that story, Birthmates, which incidentally, you know, it's from 1995, first published in the journal ProShares and then actually selected, I think along with Drinking Coffee Elsewhere by John Updike for the Best American Short Stories of the Century.
Yeah.
It's a pretty neat volume I recommend people take a look at out from Houghton Mifflin. I think what's interesting is he, unlike Dina, confronted with a racist situation or exclusionary situation, a situation where he is demeaned and not seen as a person of color, kind of takes it, right?
Yeah.
You know, like he feels like, okay, I handled that well. When someone said a slur to me at work, I think it's his boss, actually, you know, he doesn't go ballistic, and his wife feels like she should have. And I think some of the story is about what we lose, you know, what some part of our soul that we lose when we don't overtly resist and when we don't talk back. But there's a sense of getting frozen from any kind of spontaneous reaction when you inhibit yourself from reacting to something so fundamental, you know, that you should be able to go to work and no one should say something like that to you.
Absolutely.
Right. He even credits that incident with promotion. His passivity in that moment, in his mind, has led the boss to sometime later promote him.
But he even reads that as resistance. He reads that as his own version of sort of fighting back, right?
Right. Mm.
Yeah. Though there's no guarantee the promotion's actually coming. It's just a promise of one, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Did he
actually
get it?
And he has all these sort of threat competitors like Billy Shore and, mm-hmm. you know, all these people.
Right. So at what cost is the, is the question?
Yeah.
Because this is a guy who, you know, his whole life is passive.
Yep.
And he really has shut himself off and really can't experience his own feelings.
Well, I think, too, one of the most important things reading these two stories together that just strikes me now, and it's kind of resonant with Crazy Rich Asians being, you know, so prominent in the news, and there finally being the perception that someone, an actor like John Cho in Searching, could quote-unquote carry a movie and be considered virile enough. An Asian American man to carry a movie, because the horrible stereotype is a desexualization and a passivity attributed to Asian American people in general and Asian American men in a particular way, you know. And then at the same time we have Serena Williams, right, being so, you know, so punished and so mistreated, I think, for being able to be caricatured into a difficult woman of color. You know, she's portrayed as this difficult, you know, not gracious enough woman of color and all that. I mean, I think each of these stories plays with some fundamental aspect of a racial stereotype, whether it's the angry black woman stereotype that Dina is so keenly aware of and plays against in all kinds of clever ways, and then that horrible psychiatrist kind of mocks that stereotype, you know, says, oh, you know, oh yeah, you suffered, or oh yeah, you're so angry, and she really uses it in a way. It's liberating, sort of use the fact that someone would take such a low blow at you, you know, in your moment of grief and your moment of real suffering, to see that actually they know nothing. You know, she's right. Pretty clear. He's pretty clueless, that psychiatrist. And similarly, Gish Jen's character is keenly aware that even his wife, but also many other people, see him as ineffective and passive in the world. And he, at the same time, struggles with all of the things that make him afraid to be more aggressive, more proactive, and kind of look things in the face, including, you know, the loss of his own child, like really look it in the face as clearly as he actually needs to. So I think that that's also something I am really interested in as a writer, like looking at stereotypes and then looking at the psychological effect of living in a way where those stereotypes are sort of painted onto you, you know, almost like there's a glass between you and the dominant majority, and as you're walking, instead of just seeing you through the glass, they're like painting something onto it. So one of the projects I did that probably also led to this book with a group of Asian American and African American women was we made like a collage of all the racially stereotyping things that had been said to us in like the preceding 10 years or something. And it was really amazing. like people just say this stuff to us with sure. this expectation, you know, whether it's, I always think of Indian women as, you know, the kind of women who don't curse, you know, whether it's that or whether it's saying something like, you know, Indian women could really teach American women how to be better wives, you know, like how to really accept their husband's authority better. You know, like people actually say those things. These stereotypes live and breathe in our language and in our thoughts. And it's a stunning thing. And then we're caught up short by it when they're just refracted back at us in these horrific news stories, you know, where Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black child, is called a man, is called a dangerous African-American man, you know? I mean, just where these horrific stereotypes are still so alive. And I think it's important as readers, as well as writers, to read literature that examines these kind of stereotypes and subverts them and challenges them and, like Dina, you know, kind of laughs in their face, because I think that these stereotypes have now been used against us to shape the current political reality, you know, where we've elected a president who can invoke some of the worst of them to make people fear each other and to make people feel like America is a zero-sum game. And, you know, unless some people are somehow kept out of it, there just won't be enough.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a real danger and a real problem in our country that's exacerbating of people not being allowed to tell their own stories, and groups of people not being able to tell their own stories, and the narrative being told by, right now, angry politicians that perpetuate things that aren't true to people that, you know, there's large chunks of the country that don't have experience with anything outside of the sameness of their lives. And allowing this single voice to perpetuate these stereotypes, I think, does us all a disservice, and it does the people it targets a tremendous disservice isn't even the word. And it makes me sad.
And something else that you mentioned, Chaya, that I wanted to touch on that I agree with is this notion. So you mentioned that project and the things you had heard, sort of the sort of racist phrases or thoughts directed at you, are things that are said by people who probably wouldn't classify themselves as racist, right? Mm-hmm. There's this sort of weird dialogue about racism in this country where, unless you are out and out using copyrighted racial slurs, you can argue that you're not a racist, right? That your thoughts aren't racist or prejudiced, and you didn't say the N-words, therefore I'm not a racist, right?
Right.
Those phrases, and we're seeing these stories too. It's not just your choice of diction, right? It is it's a mindset and it's a thought pattern that shows up in sort of insidious and you know, seemingly innocuous ways at times. Part of the power of these stories is how it sort of reveals those things.
I think that's so right. You know, when you said that, I was picturing Dina in ZZ Packer's story, looking at those white faces, you know, of all these college girls who were so certain they knew how to judge her,
yeah,
and that they were quote unquote right, you know, in judging her as somehow a hard person or an uncaring person or a selfish person, or that there was their view of her as there's something wrong with you, you know, on a theoretical human level where they get to decide what's human and what's not.
Absolutely.
Yep.
There's that powerful moment at the end of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere where she goes to, I think, what's the girl's name? Is it Heidi?
Heidi.
Yes, Heidi.
Yes, yes.
To see her in a room, to comfort or to sort of, you know, respond to this request to travel with her. And the story seems to be on the face of it building towards a catharsis where she and Heidi have their confessional moment and their feelings are revealed finally and sort of wraps up in this kind of very happy Hollywood way. And it completely subverts that. And that's a really powerful moment from that story, is that you don't get that resolution you're looking for. You get something else that's much more powerful and specific. And I really, those last lines are chilling, I think, in how sort of well drawn they are. It's a really, it's a masterful story.
Before we have to wrap up pretty soon, but the one other scene in ZZ Packer's story specifically that I like to talk about is the scene where they spray each other with the dishwasher hose thing. It's a really sweet scene, I think, and it's very interesting how for a very brief moment their sort of situations are almost inverted. Very briefly, and the way that, or at least within the context of their relationship to each other. And they're very exposed in that moment. And there was just something really nice about that scene.
Yeah, and you get the sense that both of them fall outside of very rigid beauty norms, right? You know, and in that scene, both of their bodies are beautiful. Both of their bodies are really accepted. You know, as good, as lovely.
Yeah.
So I agree with you very much.
Also, real quick before we wrap up, sorry, one more thing that I wanted to mention or talk about is the image or I guess metaphor or symbol, what do you want to call it, of the unborn child with brittle bone syndrome from Birthmates. Of course, the story ends on that note. Something you'd mentioned before about the sort of passivity maybe or vulnerability. I hadn't thought about it. I guess that image I wrestled with when I read the story and couldn't quite decipher it, or maybe sort of felt I wasn't getting that part of the story. And something you said really unlocked it for me, that sort of sense of this fragility, the sort of feeling of being crushed under your own weight, essentially. Those last lines are powerful, but now that I sort of have them through your lens, even more so. And I feel much more, I don't know, like I want to reread that story now and think about it again.
Yeah, I mean, I really think she's so interesting, Gish Jen, too, because I strongly recommend people read her review of Lisa Coe's The Leavers, a book that many people may be familiar with, kind of one of several harrowing immigration narratives, you know, and I would say Vanessa Hua's recent book, A River of Stars, Ingrid Rojas Contreras' book, Fruit of the Drunken Tree. I really love, on the one hand, that there are these narratives of immigration and precarious movement across borders and so on. But Gish Jen, she's actually quite lacerating in that review of Lisa Coe. And what she says is, it's not enough for us as writers of color to tell stories that quote unquote need to be heard, or that, you know, quote unquote white people are so eager to make a space for. We have to have an artistic standard that even exceeds theirs, you know, like we have to allow ourselves to be fierce as artists and exacting and precise and demanding. And I must say, I think exactly the same thing is true of ZZ Packer, you know, who couldn't be more demanding or fierce. You know, we've all waited like 15 years for her novel, right? You know, like her short story collection. So pure, perfect and amazing. And I would like to end on that note, that as much as I feel like a political person and have this very, you know, left-looking spirit and feminist and queer identity going on, I think the power of these stories still is in this commonality around craft. And the real freedom is you're going to push yourself really hard, and you're not ever going to be satisfied with being tokenized or just being patted on the head to say, wow, what an interesting image, or what a beautiful image, or I'd never seen the inside of that kind of temple. You know, and instead to be thinking, when you talked about how cold the floor felt on your bare feet, did I feel it too? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chaya, tell us about your short story collection, White Elephants Dancing.
Well, I'm so grateful, you know, that there was this pathway to publish a story collection of stories very much linked by theme and emotional resonance of, you know, Me Too experiences, experiences of mostly surviving, but also at times perpetrating violence experienced by women of color, queer women of color, both Asian American women, African American women primarily. And I think maybe the best way to talk about this central image of the title and the title story, White Dancing Elephant, is that on the one hand, so many millions of people are linked by this image of a white dancing elephant because it was in the dream of the Buddha's mother before she had Prince Siddhartha, you know, who became the Buddha. And the, you know, elephants are also a way to signal beginnings. Like it's actually Ganesh Chaturthi, which is a holiday celebrating how the elephant-headed god kind of, you know, is a remover of obstacles and gives us good luck when we start ventures and stuff like that. And then other people pointed out to me from the title story, which is about a woman in her 40s in London surviving a miscarriage, that Hills Like White Elephants, you know, the Hemingway story about pregnancy loss as well. So that was also kind of interesting resonance that I hadn't even consciously, you know, thought about. And I guess, you know, a lot of the stories are about really close relationships between women and the complexity of certain kinds of intimacy. In one, Talinda, two women, one Korean-American Talinda and an Indian-American woman, really never have a chance to come to grip with the utter current of romantic love that actually they're really in, because Talinda has terminal cancer and, you know, Narika, her best friend, happens to be sleeping with Talinda's husband.
Wow.
So it's kind of like
complicated.
I really like the idea of people even being interested in reading stories that were this messy, in terms of they're not structurally messy, but they are really multi-positional on, you know, well, what am I supposed to think of a person who would do something like that? You know, well, right. You know, it's like kind of like, I don't know, you know, kind of be with her rather than think of anything particular about her, you know. And there are a couple of stories, The Goddess of Beauty Goes Bowling and Jagatheeshwaran. Jagatheeshwaran is actually up at Electric Literature. If people want to take a look, they were kind enough to run that. They're about people, various forms of disability, both physical, mental, and how they're treated by their South Asian, you know, their families, particularly their fathers. And I think, like, Forward Reviews really honored me by saying that I take on the patriarchy. And Ariana Rebellini in BuzzFeed News, you know, said that I'm this force in this provocative story collection. But I think we don't choose what makes us really, really angry and just really empowered, because we're so sure what they're doing is wrong, but, you know, a lot of words come out and they flow. And, you know, I think that there is a connection between a certain kind of intolerant and demanding, badly demanding, you know, patriarchy, and all kinds of emotional distress and disability, lack of acceptance, and I do think a lot of the negative of our world come from a certain kind of toxic masculinity. I do think that's true. And in the stories, you kind of see that again and again. There's another story, A Shaker Chair, that got a few little awards as well as the Dzank, and it's about an African-American woman, the daughter of African immigrants, actually, who is trying to cultivate this big-time career as a psychoanalyst and is derailed by her feelings about this young Indian-American patient that she has. And so it's sort of like they're in the room together. They sort of only see each other emotionally, but there's this character, Abner, this young white guy who ends up being the undoing of this black woman analyst in a way. And the things that he says, the insertions, the mansplaining, you know, all kinds of things that he does, even though he's technically in a subordinate role to this very senior, you know, really esteemed Black psychoanalyst. I have been in the room when those kind of things were said, and I found it such a joy to have a character for whom those were matter-of-fact part of the background, you know, like just part of the day,
yeah,
part of the reality. And that's what's so exciting about things like, you know, Wyatt Moore's story about Liberia, where she's not talking about poverty or villages or the Western view of Liberia. She's talking about people making choices in love or people figuring out how to be independent of their parents. You know, like all the quote-unquote normal or regular developmental tasks that all of us have. And in that story, Shaker Chair, even though there's probably a lot about racism or, you know, patriarchy, there's also at the bottom of it what you do when you fall in love with someone who is completely wrong for you to fall in love with, and all the different ways you can dysfunction, actually making sure you never touch the person, because there's no touching in the story between those two women characters, even though they're so drawn to each other. So those are a couple of the stories. There's some speculative pieces as well. There's one about a woman suffering from a newly diagnosed with a neurologic illness who sort of feels like she has to compete with her husband's android. And then there's another one about this kind of mysterious orphanage in India where the orphans have interesting, I think, powers of transformation. There are all these myths and legends about shapeshifters in Indian folklore, and so I kind of drew from that. So it is a story collection that goes a lot of different places. So I feel very grateful that it's, you know, kind of being accepted. Yeah. As a viable collection, not only by my publisher, but by, you know, Vulture, which listed it in a couple of best of fall lists, by BuzzFeed News, as I mentioned, The Rumpus, Electric Lit, The Millions included it on its, you know, best of 2018 second half, and Book Riot has featured it in a number of lists and recommended, you know, pieces, and Washington Independent Review of Book. It's out in 3 weeks, so it's kind of freaking me out a little bit. It's out on October 9th. I think I'm very inspired, too, that, you know, both Gish Jen and Zizi Packer publishing many years ago, right? Like, Zizi Packer, I think, like, 99 or 2000, you know, like a while ago, right?
Yeah.
These were both disparate story collections, kind of going against the publishing wisdom that story collections are somehow dead and you have to write a quote-unquote linked story collection. And right. Linked story collections are wonderful. You know, I really love Jennifer Egan's A Visit to the Goon Squad as an example of that. But, you know, there's a future. There's a way forward for stories that are really linked by nothing more than the author's preoccupations of theme and sensibility, and hopefully, you know, by our voice, and not by different moments in a particular set of characters' lives, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that's pretty cool, but I hope so much that people will consider giving my book a read, but more than that, you know, engaging it in the larger conversation about these stories by writers of color, women of color, queer people, which really try to define stories and define themes on our own terms without reference to. And then if you're not that, or you don't identify as that, we're inviting you in. But we're not labeling the furniture, you know, like we're not pandering in any way. And I'm really excited by that.
Absolutely. That sounds fantastic. Well, thank you again. We really appreciate it. And look for White Dancing Elephants October 9th in bookstores for sure.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. Have a wonderful night.
You too. Take care. Yak babies, yakking off.